So I entitled this retreat, Going On Beyond the 10 Oxherding Pictures. So now I have to give a Dharma talk on that, which I think takes incredible chutzpah, because we've got these incredible pictures that show the depth of the path, and I'm thinking there's an on beyond to go to, and I'm going to tell you about it. I'm not so sure about that. Anyway. So just a quick reminder, you know, the 10 pictures that start out with the fellow searching for his ox. So, you know, in my mind, this is beginning with duality, and it goes through his, you know, capturing, finding and capturing and taming the ox and all the difficulty of that, and then being at ease with the ox, and then there's the big wowie-zowie moment of the eighth picture where everything disappears into great mystical oneness and deep understanding. And then, you know, returning to the marketplace in the 10th picture with bliss bestowing hands. And I think all of us were here for at least some of those talks, so you know a little bit about that backdrop. But I'm not sure how critical that's going to be to what I have to say. So we'll see where we end up. So I wanted to give you a little bit of history of Zen, because I found in, you know, in reading and reflecting and sitting with this after our time in January together, I found that this is really that this sets up, or this expresses ways of thinking that are typical to Zen that go way back to the beginning. And you can go back to Nagarjuna in the first century AD. Nagarjuna is in our ancestral line, Nagarjuna, if you may remember it. We chanted his name this morning. He is more or less credited somewhat with the beginning of Mahayana Buddhism, in great part because of his writings on emptiness. But he is also the one who developed this teaching of the two truths, which permeates Mahayana Buddhism from then on. The two truths are absolute truth and relative truth. So you've got truth that's contingent, relative truth, relative, you know, and you've got truth that's unconditioned, not dependent on conditions. So that dichotomy, if you will, got set up right at the beginning. And that dichotomy then permeates all the rest of Zen. It gets expressed in Hua Yen Buddhism, which is the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, for those of you who go that route and are familiar with or even know that name, is the sort of ultimate expression of Hua Yen philosophy. It's giant and it's difficult. But Hua Yen philosophy followed in the ensuing centuries and was maybe at its peak in the 600s-700s. And it took this idea of absolute and relative and created four permutations of the way in which absolute and relative interact. And the fundamental teaching of Hua Yen, to my mind, has to do with this the understanding of how all things interpermeate each other. The classic metaphor for this is the jewel net of Indra, where you've got a net and a jewel on at every node of the net, and every jewel reflects every other jewel. So every jewel is reflected in every other jewel. Kareem, you're getting the incense. Sorry. So everything is inside everything else. One way that it's expressed is that particulars don't obstruct each other. So no thing obstructs any other thing. Everything is interpermeating each other. Everything is interfused with everything else. So I'm inside all of you. You're all inside of me. You know, take that to include the whole universe and you've got it. Right? I think it's an amazing teaching. And I think, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh tried to express this through the use of the word interbeing, with which some of you may be familiar with. So for me, this sense of the absolute and the particular and how they interrelate becomes a theme for Zen for the rest of its history. Absolute truth, relative truth, the universe and particulars. My way of expressing this is, how do we get from the great mystical experience that you got here in picture 8, how do we get from that to our ordinary daily lives? Or how do we put those two together? How do we not view them as not just separate from each other, but in some ways antithetical to each other and standing against each other? And I think in the 10 ox herding pictures, the 10th picture, you know, returning to the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands is an attempt to express that. You know, we go back to our ordinary daily lives, but we've been changed by the experience we've been through. You know, the search, all the spiritual work we've done, all the practice and training we've done changes us in ways we may not even be aware of, in ways other people may not be aware of. But it has an effect, you know, when we go back into our lives. And even the saying going back doesn't quite make sense, because we're in our lives all the time, aren't we? So we're not going back. But gradually over the years, we have embodied something that naturally expresses itself as we go through our daily life. And I think of it less in terms of how do we get absolute and relative truth together, and more in terms of how do we bring mystical experience and daily life together. And, you know, there's this whole bunch of opposites that are used to express this dichotomy, or, you know, this koan, or this difficulty, if you will. A difficulty is maybe too hard a word, but... another way I like of putting it is noumenal and phenomenal. You know, phenomenal has to do with things and daily events, and noumenal with the mystical, or that which has to do with God, or, you know, the spiritual. And again, we split these things up, perhaps unfairly, and then we've created for ourselves the project of getting them back together. Universal in particular, emptiness and form, wisdom and compassion. You know, there's these sets of two that go together, in effect, complete each other. Does that make sense? Okay. So in the history of Zen, that gets expressed in various ways by various people. And a whole lot of the koan stories, if you're familiar with them, have to do with this and how you cut through the thinking mind to obliterate the dichotomy, or, you know, or the sense of these things standing against each other. In, you know, the 7th to the 9th centuries, there was this incredible flowering of Zen. There are an amazing number of great masters who lived then and whose stories have come down to us. And one of them was Sekito Kisen, who again is in our ancestral line, and he wrote the Sando Kai, which we just recited. And the Sando Kai is itself an attempt to address this koan, this paradox, this difficulty, if you will. And if you consider lines like, at the very beginning, it says, each sense gate and its object altogether enter thus in mutual relations, and yet stand apart in a uniqueness of their own, depending and yet non-depending both. So there's the all is different and all is one, depending, not depending. Sense gate, like the eye, its object, what it sees, altogether entering in mutual relations. You know, so it's an attempt to undercut that sense of separateness, and we'll come back to that. I would say that the Sando Kai probably appeared about 800, and then Tozan Ryokai, who is also in our ancestral line, who in Chinese is known as Dongshan, Tozan Ryokai wrote The Most Excellent Mirror Samadhi. And The Most Excellent Mirror Samadhi, at its beginning, has this image. The white snow falls upon the silver plate. The snowy heron in the bright moon hides. Resembles each the other, yet these two are not the same. Combining them, we can distinguish one from other. And what this is about is, you can think of the bright moon as the unborn, and the snowy heron, which is often translated, by the way, as egret. It's, you know, white heron. somehow snowy heron's more poetic to me, but, you know, the snowy heron is the particulars. The snowy heron in the bright moon hides. How do we tell the particulars from the unborn? Is the unborn separate from the particulars? So this is an image in which the author is attempting to express or enable us to see the all is one and the all is different at the same time. You know that teaching of Reverend Master Jiyu's. Enlightenment is all is one and all is different, and being able to see that that is so at the same time, that those don't stand against each other. So this image is, you know, an image, a physical expression of that teaching, an attempt to show us how that could be. Okay, so, and part of what I'm trying to do here is show you how these practices that we do are ancient. You know, we're talking about the 7th, 8th, 9th century here, you know, and the Sandokan and Most Excellent Mirror Samadhi, I think, have been recited in Zen temples since the 19th century. That didn't start back in the 800s, but they've been used all that time, which is pretty neat, I think. Our practices aren't arbitrary, you know. And I think that, you know, all of this, what I'm trying to demonstrate here is this kind of fundamental theme in our tradition of Buddhism, in the Soto Zen tradition of Buddhism, and in our lineage, you know, this ancestral line that we recite every day. And that kind of, in a sense, culminates in Dogen, and Dogen's fundamental question, which was, if everybody's Buddha, then why are we training? What's all this fuss about, since we're all already Buddha anyway? And then, of course, it comes forward into, you know, our present time and our own training and practice. And Reverend Master Jiyu, when she went to Japan and she asked, you know, how can I train deeply? How can I really do this? How can I find the perfection of Zen, was how she put it. They said to her, just live. And her... Yeah, her response to that was, are you kidding? You know, I came all this way and I had to save all this money and this is your response to me, you know? she found out later that it was the best response. You know, but we'll try to get to that. Now, Tozan Ryokai, or Dongshan, had a teacher named Yunyan. And when Tozan Ryokai asked his teacher, I want to get this exact wording here, he asked him, as he was leaving his teacher to go out and teach himself and practice on his own, he asked him, later on, if I am asked to describe your reality or your teaching, how should I respond? After some pause, Yunyan said, just this is it. Just this is it. It's the title of this very nice book by Tigan Dan Layton, for those of you who like to read, or those of you who like Tigan Dan Layton, if you know of him. He's a pretty good translator of Zen texts, and has translated a lot of Dogen, by the way. So here's a whole book called Just This Is It. I love it. I think of you every time, Ken. This is it, Lane. Did you name that?
Alan Watts essay.
Right, yeah. Dongshan and the Practice of Suchness. So that's why I'm telling you that Dongshan is his Chinese name, so you know that this is, Dongshan is actually Tozan Ryokai. And, you know, another aspect of this way of thinking is other teachings that have come down to us as kinds of aphorisms. Aphorisms. I was getting confused with aphids. Quite related, right? That we find, you know, commonly in Zen, and in some sense even get misused, like everyday mind is the way, or this very mind is Buddha. And Dogen's teaching that training and enlightenment are one, and what we talk about in our own order, the koan appears naturally in daily life. You know, you don't have to work your way through a bunch of koan stories to get enlightened. It's in front of you. It's right in front of your face. Solve the problem that's in front of you, you know. So, again, in all of these renditions or ways of putting it, the question that's being asked is, how do we bridge the gap between our fallible, flawed selves and Buddha? And how do we become that great? How does little old me, you know, who's a worm, scum, you know, all that stuff, how do I get to be this great Buddha? And of course, there are all these writings, like the Avatamsaka Sutra is one of them, that try to convey the greatness of Buddhahood and what it takes to get there. And in millions of kalpas, you can't even touch it, you know? So just, I mean, it makes you feel like you want to just forget it. And at the same time, we're told we're already Buddha. And how do we bridge that gap, you know? And the ox herding picture set out with the same dichotomy, the boy and the ox, ordinary mind and Buddha mind, separate from each other, the search and the accomplishment of the goal. You know, he does the, as we said and know, he does the whole search thing and becomes enlightened and everything's wonderful. And the commentary for the very first picture, the boy searching for the ox, says, the bull never has been lost. What need is there to search? Only because of separation from my true nature, I fail to find him. One of Tozan Ryokai's, that's just this is it guy, one of his disciples says, if you want such a thing, you must be such a person. Already being such a person, why trouble about such a thing? So this sense of paradox or contradiction runs through everything, right? And in a sense, it's what we face in our own daily lives, trying to live the Dharma as we know it and being confronted with who we turn out to be after all. You know, all the blunders and failings and weaknesses and that kind of thing. But I think it's really interesting that in the very first ox herding pictures, they say, what need is there to search? You know, you're setting out on this search. It's a good thing to do. You finally figured out what to do with your life after all that's meaningful and has some purpose to it. And the first thing they say is, what need is there to search? And it gets totally undercut right from the beginning. And they don't even wait till the 10th picture to tell you there's no need to search. You know, you had it all the time. Or till you figure that out somewhere along the way, you know, or you become one with the ox and everything's fine. And so it says, what need is there to search? Only because of separation from my true nature. And I think this is the key. Separation. I think I've probably said this to you before. Separation to me is the fundamental koan. All of our other questions, all of our other frustrations, misunderstandings, come out of this fundamental koan, which is that we think we're separated from our true nature. We think we're separated from everybody else and everything else. But we think that our true nature, or we think that Buddha is different from us. It's somewhere else. And we have to become it, or we have to find it. We have to get it back. Or we have to do a whole bunch of work to make ourselves into something different. And that fundamental belief that we're separate is actually not true. It's actually the fundamental lie. It's not true, but we're so convinced of its truth. And we're so convinced, you know, I mean, it's so how else are you going to think about it? You know, you can take a rope, and I can jump a rope, right? And the rope and I don't get mixed up. We're separate, right? This thing here seems so concretely separate. And it seems to me that almost everything or everything in our practice is designed to undermine that belief or that sense, that experience that we're separate, and find a way to cut through it. And all this whole sense of paradox and this whole, you know, kind of difference between absolute and relative truth or mystical experience in our daily life comes out of this notion that we're separate. Okay? Kind of the deep-seated belief that we're scum and not Buddha. And the knowing of not separate is, in a sense, the knowing of mystical experience. I mean, when we talk about Kensho or Satori or religious experience, part of what we're talking about is non-separation. We're actually experiencing that non-separation. You can experience yourself containing the whole universe, you know, or the whole universe containing you, or Carl Sagan's "We're Made of Stardust," you know. I'm not sure that's what he meant by that, but it's a way of expressing it. And the mystical experience isn't the end of the story, right? We go on to, you know, all things appearing within emptiness, and then we go on to returning to the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. Now, what I think is the going on beyond returning to the marketplace. And you've still got Hote there looking, you know, like conspicuous, yeah? This fat, laughing guy with the bag and hanging out in bars and brothels and enlightening everyone. He looks a little conspicuous. You know, there's still a little bit of a something there. Mm-hmm. This is just a sort of niggle I've got. And I think the attempt with something like just this is it, and you can capitalize that I on the it, just this is it, or not. Maybe we don't need to capitalize it. Maybe it's just very ordinary. That the just this is it or the just live is what's past that 10th picture. And it's something that's so ordinary that we can't believe it's the solution, you know, that we can't believe it's the answer. But it's what cuts through separation. And expressions like just live or just this is it are an attempt to cut through that separation. But to me, it's kind of an excruciating ordinariness because we don't want it to be that plain. We want there to be something greater or more fantastic or more amazing. And we keep wanting, you know, till we've got that or think we've got that or we're doing something to get that. Does this ring true for you all? This is what happens to me. And it brings to mind for me a line from a poem. I can't remember if it was Rilke or Gerard Manley Hopkins. Ordinary and extraordinary as rain. As rain?
As rain.
As ordinary and extraordinary as rain. When you think about rain, it's very everyday, but it's also quite incredible, isn't it? And it sustains all life. So, on the one hand, it's excruciatingly ordinary, and on the other hand, it's extraordinarily ordinary. Does that make sense? Okay. So, this brings me to the whole notion of effort. And we talked about this some in January, and I may be just repeating what we said then. But as I go on, you know, I love this, if I can find what I read to you earlier about in order to, where is it? Maybe I can't find it. Anyway, in order to want such a thing or get such a thing, you must be such a person. But since you are such a person, why bother to, you know, that one? So, you know, why bother with the effort? Why make, what's all the fuss about, you know? Again, we so badly want this thing, we work so hard to get it, but why are we bothering since it's already there? And also for me, It's becoming more and more and more clear to me how there is the key to everything is relaxing. I mean, this seems absurd and ridiculous to me. It's the key to the whole thing. It's the key to the whole practice. And I find myself periodically wanting to get up on a soapbox and sort of start yelling and screaming at people and saying, you know, how badly do you really want to do this? You know, does this really matter to you or not? And what are you willing to give up? And how much are you willing for your life to change? And, you know, renunciation is total. You can't keep anything. You know, do you really want it or not? And I'm saying this to myself, too. I mean, I sound like I'm, you know, getting on everyone else's case, but I'm saying the same thing to myself. And, you know, come on with this really heavy, strong, you know, forget the resistance, put it down. You know, can you give up being comfortable? Can you give up your job, your friends, your everything, the things you love to do? Because you value this so much. And if it's not that important to you, well, forget it, go home, you know? And on the other hand, this recognition that relaxation is the key to the whole thing. And I don't know that I can adequately say that to you, but everything else depends on that. And when we sit down and you know, the more I keep stumbling across the word in the things that I'm reading, I never saw it, you know, years ago, but now I see it everywhere. When we sit down to meditate, the first thing we need to do is relax. And we're still in this upright posture. This relaxation is not being a blob. You know, we don't become sort of gelatin, half liquefied by the sun. There's a verve in it, you know, and there's a kind of focused attention or awareness that's crucial to it. And that kind of focus and attention is it's just, the awareness aspect of it is as fundamental as the relaxing is. And so somehow those two have to be brought together. And sometimes I think of, when I think of the awareness aspect, I think of that sort of single pointed focus. I've never done martial arts, but that I think somebody must have to break a cinder block with the side of their hand. You know, there's something about that that's extremely one-pointed, but also relaxed, I think. So in some sense, our effort needs to be put towards relaxing. Now, another aspect, I sometimes think that, you know, that if you think of this as sequential, you know, you start looking for the ox and the whole experience is sequential, in the beginning there has to be a lot of effort. And later on, you know, he's hanging out, he's playing his flute on the back of the ox, he's hanging out in front of his hut, you know, at ease. He's having a good time, he's at ease. Sometimes I think, you know, earlier in life, you really have to work hard, and later in life, like we all are, you can rest a bit. You know, you've accumulated what you needed to do to have children, raise them, support yourself and them, and all of that stuff. And later in life, you can relax. So, is this something that depends on a kind of stage that you're in or not? I don't know. It's what I can see from where I am right now, you know, that this sense of relaxing is extremely fundamental, but it must be joined with this kind of verb or awareness. And those two together create the foundation for everything else that we do. Sekito Kisen, who wrote the Sandokai, right? He says, I'm sorry, did I get them mixed up? Yeah, no, he wrote the Sandokai. Bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. And I think there's an interesting juxtaposition in that, between relaxation and that awareness, because he says, don't give up. Don't give up. But let go of 100 years and relax completely. So there you have it. I think that the key thing with effort is, or, you know, when effort becomes striving, maybe it's because there's clinging. If our effort is clinging to something, our effort has gone off base, if you will. If we notice that we're clinging, let go. And then the effort can become appropriate. Now, the other thing I wanted to address a little bit that's left over from January is this notion, or this, we talk a lot about deepening our practice. How can I deepen my practice? I think that's a very valid question to ask, and at the same time, it's another one of those traps. Now, my master used to say that you deepen your training by training, and training will naturally, if you're doing the training, it will naturally pull you deeper. And I think that's really valuable teaching. We can actually trust the practice. We can trust the training. All we have to do is do it, and that will pull us deeper. But I think that sometimes that deeper, well, maybe not sometimes. It may be that ultimately that deeper is this incredibly ordinary everyday life that we live. You know, just this is it, is us sitting here right now, listening to a Dharma talk. Drinking tea, when we drink tea, vacuuming our carpet, you know, going to the grocery store, figuring out our car insurance. It may that be that that's it, you know? And there's something in me that rails against that. And at the same time, that's, I keep coming back to that. And in fact, coincidentally, two of the most senior monks in our order said something like that to me in the last couple of weeks. Just kind of, I mean, we weren't talking about anything. And Reverend Master Hario said, you know, people talk about deeper meditation. I wonder what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, meditation's just meditation. It's just, what's the deeper bit, you know? And somebody else said the same thing about, well, ordinary life, what else is there, you know? Anyway, so I've been talking as long as I'm supposed to be talking, except we started late. And, of course, I have a whole page to go. Can I go on for a few minutes?
Please.
I'm sorry?
We'll drink tea fast.
We'll drink tea fast. Yeah, that's right. I'm dripping on some cake. There's this book.
No.
There's this book called, have we got hot water? We're going to get hot water. Excellent.
It has to be kept. You have to
keep doing it. Right. Okay. There's a book, Dongshan's Five Ranks, written by Russ Bolliter, who is a teacher in Western Australia, a Zen teacher. And again, Dongshan is Tozan Ryokai, right, in our lineage. The Five Ranks teaching is a teaching that, again, permeates our tradition. Dogen didn't think much of it. Other people think it's terrific. I've always wanted to study it, so I studied it a little bit. Now, it's a little bit dangerous for me to even raise it because it can appear so complex, so obtuse, so inaccessible. You know, you've got to be enlightened to understand it and all that kind of thing. So, and you know, again, like the Oxfording pictures, it comes with poems and commentary, and it's all written in this language that's obfuscating, and you got to untangle it, you know, and know what they were talking about back then. I've reduced it to this. The five ranks, or another way to put it would be the five positions or relationships between ruler and minister. Ruler and minister in China is a way of saying absolute and relative, or universal and particular, or noumenal and phenomenal, you know, what we've been talking about, okay? The five positions between mystical experience and daily life, all right? Now, so the five positions are, and there's a lot of different translations, so bear with me. But the first one is the apparent within the real, or we could say daily life within mystical experience, okay? The second is the real within the apparent, or mystical experience within daily life. The third is emerging from within the real, emerging from mystical experience. Moving in the midst of both real and apparent, arriving completely in both, I'm sorry, that's the fourth. The fifth is arriving completely in both, or both in accord, both in harmony with each other. So, or, you know, another way of putting that fifth one is freely using either the phenomenal or ineffable. This is the way Bolliter puts it at one point. Freely using either the phenomenal or the ineffable reality without attaching to either and without seeing them as separate. So that's the fifth one. And these are actually referred to in the most excellent mirror samadhi, which we recited this morning. The words return again to the first pattern after changes five. This has the five. This it's talking about the Lee hexagram. How do we say it?
Five tasted the chi grass.
Well, that comes in a bit. Return again to the first pattern after changes five refers to a I Ching hexagram and the different forms it can take. This has the five tastes of the chi grass seams and as the diamond scepter's branches five. The absolute upright holds as it is many phenomena within its own delicate balance. The absolute upright refers to the universal or the noumenal. Many phenomena, the particulars. So see, this kind of thing is embedded in our language in all kinds of places, and we kind of don't notice it anymore. I don't. So the way I think of what I think this teaching of the five ranks is doing is it's trying to give us, take these two things and show the permeations or the dance of the relationships between them. So instead of two, you've now got five. So it reduces the sense of opposition. And it's I think it's trying to open up the ways in which we can put the universal and the particular or mystical experience in daily life together, the different ways in which we experience them. So these two things, which seem opposed to each other, we can then meet in our daily experience as dancing between each other, creating different configurations. Configurations is the word I'm looking for. So different configurations and how they relate to each other. Okay, so that's the value I see in that experience, and the reason I bring up the five ranks is because it's again teaching in our lineage which attempts to address this disparity we seem to find between that which is of oneness or the universal and the mundanity, what the apparent mundaneness of normal everyday existence. So I think what we're talking about here is on the one hand the realization of the ultimate and its functioning within phenomenon. How does that realization we have of the ultimate, and we've talked, you know, in January about how we all have some intuitive sense of the ultimate or of Buddha or of whatever you want to call it, or of oneness, and how does that recognition we have then function in our daily lives? And, you know, how does our religious experience express itself in our daily lives? And ultimately, in a sense, it has to just disappear. You know, and again, we touched on that in January. You know, in the end, we can't go, you know, charging down the street saying, I've got it, I've got it, everybody listen to me. You know, we're just living, and it's somehow naturally expressing itself without our having any awareness of it or doing anything with it. So we live from just this is it, and our lives are an ongoing dance of the subtle relationships between the mystical and the concrete, or the noumenal and the phenomenal. Whenever we try to talk about it, it becomes all fixed and hard. But if we can think about it as this kind of fluid flowing interaction that shifts and changes and sometimes looks like this and sometimes looks like that, and which we're mostly not aware of, that these things constantly interfuse each other, then we've got no problem, right? And we're free. There's no separation. This is what undercuts the separation. Ha ha, we got it. It's so easy. And just to throw in one more word here, I think of the just is it, just this is it, as an expression of a kind of ultimate intimacy, if you will, that our just being right here, right now, completely present with what we've got, and that includes our whole past and our whole future, that's a kind of intimacy that is unbeatable. You know, it's non-rejection. It's a willingness to fully accept what we've got. And to me, that's the undercutting of the separation. That's the recognition of the non-existence of the separation. And it's not like we're sitting here saying, oh, you know, I'm totally present here. There's no separation. Because that separates immediately, right? But to whatever extent we can come bring ourselves right into this moment, right now, here we are, about to end the Dharma talk. And that is, to me, what Zen is trying to show us. And help us. What'd you say?
Opening the hand of thought.
There you go.
That's it.
Yeah.
So
I'll just end with a little quote from Hongzhi, it's probably how you say it. He wrote a book called Cultivating the Empty Field, which is just a spectacular book on our meditation practice, written from the mystical side of things. It's really lovely. I can't remember when he lived. Does anybody here? I think 1100, 1200, something like that. He wrote, "Where emptiness is empty, where emptiness is empty, it contains all of existence." That's a bit like this, right? But he's emptying out even emptiness. He's saying emptiness is empty too, right? "Where existence exists, it joins the single emptiness. The merging of sameness and difference becomes the entire creation's mother." I think of that as being like Prajnaparamita, the mother of the Buddhas. He doesn't say it becomes the entire creation. He says it becomes the entire creation's mother. "This realm manifests the energy of the many thousands of beings." We could spend a Dharma talk on that, couldn't we? Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll be quiet now. Let's get some coffee and cake, and thank you all for listening.